we're back. Welcome once again to another episode of Mike, Mike, and Oscar. And as we continue through this Oscars week here, hashtag Oscar week, no S, Mike, Mike, and Oscar. And Mike, the hits keep on coming, and we are talking to some important people that are giving us some of their valuable time. We cannot thank them enough.
Scott Feinberg of The Hollywood Reporter.
The man!
He is our idol.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, award season commentary. He hosts the Awards Chatter podcast on the Hollywood Reporter podcast network.
We stalked him is what we did. We stalked Scott Feinberg of the Hollywood Reporter. This is Mike, Mike, and Oscar. I'm co-host Mike One, and this is co-host also Mike.
Also Mike here. It helps that he kind of grew up a couple minutes away.
We didn't realize
that. I mean, we're from Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Scott's from Connecticut. We knew that much, but we didn't realize how close he was to us, how many of the same circles we're all in a way. And it was just, it was awesome because we've been following Scott well before we started this podcast. The Feinberg forecast is something that it brightens up my day every time it comes out. It is something that I sink my teeth into. I usually start a Google document every time there's a new Feinberg forecast and do my worst with that. He's on the Awards Chatter pod at THR, The Hollywood Reporter. He's a host of a lot of interviews, post-film festivals, Q&As, post-screenings there for the SAG-AFTRA and several other organizations. This guy is the Hollywood Insider extraordinaire. He is the Oscarologist.
Mike. Yeah, if you have any interest in award season at large, you already know the name Scott Feinberg. You obviously know the name The Hollywood Reporter, one of the most important trades in the industry. We reached out to him, you know, tongue-in-cheek jokes aside about stalking and being felons. We did reach out to him. He was nice enough. And The Hollywood Reporter was nice enough to give us a couple moments of his time. Really a great in-depth interview. We touched on not only Scott's road to THR, yes, but his thoughts about, obviously, the Oscars this season, specifically certain categories and generally big picture stuff we were able to talk about. He gave us more than his fair share of time, and we cannot thank him enough for that.
He gave us some of his origin story, and he was also more than happy to dive into some of these categories like we've been doing for a while. We got a lot of our thoughts validated.
Yeah.
To the point where, like, I'm like cheering while he's talking, like with my hands in the air. I'm like fist pumping. I'm channeling my inner Guido there.
Yeah.
But Mike, also, I think it's important to note, we recorded this interview with him on Friday. Since then, they're going to present all 24 categories now. So he was talking about that fact that everybody was a little bit ornery over the whole issue in the middle of the podcast somewhere there here. But other than that, you know, I think a lot of his analysis will hold. And this is an episode you can listen to beyond the Oscars because we did so much career backstory, origin story work with him.
The knowledge that this guy has from his years in the industry and his road to getting to where he is, it was just a labor of love, a passion project. It's really, really one of the more fascinating conversations that we probably will ever have, and we are very thankful. This is the interview, MMO interview, is the latest installment on your Oscar week entry for this Tuesday. You're getting us, the two mics, talking to Scott Feinberg of The Hollywood Reporter. Check it out. All right, Scott Feinberg on the line from The Hollywood Reporter. Scott, this is Mike One. We really, really appreciate you giving us the time of day here to being on here. So we just wanted to thank you right off the top, start you off with an easy softball question. Who's going to win Best Picture this year and why, of course?
Oh my God! Right in the deep end. Oh God! Well, thank you for having me. And look, I think that, like all of us, we're trying to figure out how the preferential ballot is going to factor into this, because it supposedly rewards, you know, movies that everybody at least likes, which happen not to be the two that are widely talked about as the front runners. So we've all been saying, is it going to be Roma? Is it going to be Green Book? Well, these are two movies that people either love or hate. And so it would suggest, actually, that, you know, it very well could be another one. Maybe Black Klansman, which I've heard a lot of momentum for in the last few days as I've been talking to voters. But the thing is, with something like that, other than saying my gut tells me this is what it's going to be, I can't justify it. So I think if I'm going to be wrong, I at least want to be wrong with statistics and other things supporting why I made that pick. So I am going to still, you know, stick with Roma, but I would just say for anyone who, you know, is still listening beyond that I would not be shocked if it was anything except Vice or Bohemian Rhapsody, because I feel like those other six beyond Roma and Green Book are, or the other four that are, you know, not Roma, not Green Book, not Vice, and not Bohemian Rhapsody, the others each sort of fit the preferential ballot model. So, you know, Black Klansman, but also Stars Born, Black Panther, The Favorite, they are sort of non-objectionable, and or, you know, and sometimes it's the least objectionable movie that wins.
I would like to just say that's why Scott's the best in the business.
The best.
We started that. We wanted to start that off as just like a joke. And
a
then
joke,
you go
like,
off
you know, give us your best picture
on this in-depth, well-thought-out, articulate response. And that couldn't have asked for anything better. But thank you once again for being on, and thank you for those thoughts.
Yeah, you're the man, Scott. Again, thank you. You know, every day we get a new Feinberg Forecast or Awards Chatter podcast. You know, that's a special day for us. We love your work, man. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Just wanted to get started off with a question here. I don't know where I got it from, but you know, where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
that's very cute. I am from New Haven, Connecticut.
Yes,
and my parents are lawyers. My dad worked for a family business; was the lawyer for the family business, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom after I was born. I'm the oldest, but so she stopped practicing, but still a lawyer. And I guess that answers the question.
So how does the son of two attorneys there in New Haven, from obviously the opposite coast of Hollywood, we share that in common. This is a Connecticut podcast. You're from here originally as well. How does that guy end up working for one of the most established brands in Hollywood and becoming such a powerful voice and a reporter in the industry?
Well, it's a very unexpected thing, but I really got into movies by falling in love with older movies when I was in still junior high school, I guess. It was about, I think, eighth or ninth grade. And what happened was there was a question on a trivia show basically saying which of these four movies was recently identified as the greatest of all time by the American Film Institute. And I was sort of just generally a trivia buff. I felt like I should know a little bit about a lot of things. I just sort of prided myself in that stuff. And I was embarrassed that I had not seen any of the four, I think, and maybe hadn't even heard of a few of them. So I said, look, even though it's going to suck, I'm going to suffer through it. On one long weekend, I'm going to rent all four of these and just power through it. And then I can at least say, just the same reason sometimes people read Ulysses. It's not fun, but you can say you did it. supposedly the greatest book, you know, I was going to try to do that. And so I did. And what I was shocked to find was that I loved them. And I wanted to find the other 96 movies on that list of the 100 greatest. And so I thought, all right, within the course of my lifetime, I want to finish all 100.
Sure.
And then, found that I had done that within a year. I did have a life. I did, you know, it wasn't just like living in a cave, but I that's how I spent a lot of my free time and just really fell in love with it. And so at that point I needed more lists of great older movies to check out. And it somehow occurred to me, well, maybe I should look at the list of Academy Award winners and nominees and whatever, because those lists I'm not going to get through so quickly. And so it was very inadvertently in the course of doing that I started to realize, just looking at these lists of how things worked in years past, that, all right, so I've now, this kind of a movie beats this kind of a movie. This kind of a performance tends to beat this kind of a performance. And obviously the membership of the Academy has changed over the years, and people have died off and new people have come on and all of that. But even now that they, in the last few years, since they've changed the makeup of the place a lot, there are still certain things that just sort of hold true. And so what then happened, just sort of by fate, was that the library where I was renting all of these VHSs from, somebody there mentioned to the local ABC affiliate that, hey, we've got this, or I guess, no, they first mentioned to the local New Haven Register, hey, we've got this kind of strange kid here who's doing this, watching all these old movies, you should do an item on him. So they did a story, which then got the attention of the local ABC affiliate, which said, wait a minute, it's Oscar time. Why don't we have you come on and give us your predictions? I think they figured they'd get like a little kind of kid Today Show type segment, a little, you know, kind of cute thing. What they didn't realize was that I took it pretty seriously and came on and gave them, you know, some analysis. And even though I don't think I got everything right that first year, I could talk about it in a sort of interesting way. And so and I promise this is not going to go on much longer, but just to answer your question,
this is fascinating.
I then
you
got
your time.
Great.
So they had me come on. They had me come back the next year and the next year and the next year because they just figured, like, this is the guy that we should have to talk about the Oscars. And so sort of by the time I was ready to go off to college, I was known in the area, at least among my family and friends and whatever, right, as the guy who could tell you what was going to win, what you needed to see, all of that. And so people were saying when I was going off to college, they're like, how are we going to know what's going to win? What should we see? And I said, I've heard about this exciting, you know, kind of new thing called a blog, and I will figure out how to make one, and then I'll send you the address and you guys can follow it. And so I went to blog.com and I created they allow you to kind of just pick a template and pick a name or whatever. So I went off to college with this thing called andthewinneris.blog.com, where I just started, you know, again, once maybe on a Sunday or whatever in college, I'd go see the movies that were in the conversation and do my own little take and whatever. And it was never with the intention of anyone but friends and family knowing about it. But I guess through the power of Google, people elsewhere found out about it. And so when I, just as I was graduating from college, I received some outreach from the LA Times that they were finding that this kind of coverage could have ads sold on it and be valuable to them on top of what they had in print. So they said, look, you don't have to move to LA, but you can, we'd like this kind of coverage for us. And would you do it? And I should say that when I was in college, this outreach had even started from publicists that I guess had found it through Google or whatever. And so I had started to interview current people, just as when I was in high school still, I had started to reach out to the older movie stars who were part of these older movies, because I felt like I wish other young people cared about these older movies. Mm. The way I think I can make that happen is, as a young person, maybe I can write a book that will get other, you know, young people to care. Mm. And so I started interviewing whichever of the great older stars I could track down. And now I was applying that interviewing skills to whatever I had to doing that with current people who were now being pushed for current Oscars, who were being offered to me because of the blog. So bottom line, I graduate, I go to start with the LA Times, still from the East Coast. I moved to New York. And then after a few years, I went, you know, starting in 2011 at the Hollywood Reporter. And so it's a very long answer to a short question.
No, Mike and I were just smiling throughout that answer because we have so much in common with you. Are you like our spirit animal? You're definitely, you know, our godfather.
Well, what we're saying is, can you adopt us, basically, is more or less that. Now, that's amazing. So this was basically just a labor of love and a passion that you had because you were such a cinephile and a film fanatic at such a young age. And so obviously that's something that's kind of translated into your awards chatter podcast for the Hollywood Reporter, that your podcaster that you do a phenomenal job with. My question is, though, as the pundit that you are, when you have to report on these, do you find yourself having to separate, you know, the film fan in you from the pundit in you? Or is it kind of something that you try to hold off personal bias?
No, definitely. I mean, you learn. I've just hopefully gotten a little better over the years. I mean, there was a year when I thought Juno was the greatest thing personally. I loved it. And I convinced myself that Juno was going to win. And that was stupid because there was not the justification to do that. But, you know, I think you need a lesson like that to get better at what you do and say, it's not, you know, you've got to separate yourself. It's not about you. And so, you know, what I like about what I do as far as my job is that there are aspects of it where I am totally dispassionate. It's not about what I think. So with the forecast that we do each week, it's trying to just purely look at what the evidence suggests is going to happen and get it right. Then there are things where I'll write columns or other things where it's more about opinion. And then there's the podcast where I can be a little bit, you know, it comes back to sort of what I was doing originally as a fan to an extent, but also, you know, you want to, each one of these takes hours and hours and hours of research and prep. And I'm happy to do that because I think the goal with each one of them, where we're sitting down and going through somebody's entire life and career, not just what they're currently promoting, is to do the definitive interview with that person and hopefully shed some new light. But that requires a lot of research and prep because many of these people have done a lot of interviews. And so the challenge that I pose to myself is find the kernel, like in, if you're reading 6 inches of material on somebody, read it so carefully that you find the little tidbit that has escaped most other people and then get them talking about that. Or phrase your questions in a way that is, you know, or order them in a way that is going to make them think about something themselves that they haven't regularly talked about. It's not always going to happen, but, you know, quite often it does that you get somebody to kind of break off of their talking points and actually be a little introspective.
I mean, that's spoken like a true lawyer, I could say. You definitely spent your time around some attorneys in your days, as I am one myself. I could speak to that. But
Right.
Yeah, I got a goofy question on top of that, because of the scope and the stakes of all this. You're talking to the biggest stars in Hollywood on a weekly basis with the SAG-AFTRA, Q&As, with all the Q&As you do, really, of course, with the Awards Chatter podcast. I mean, do you get starstruck, or can you kind of focus, like you said, on their backgrounds? How much do you get to know them before you interview them? Is there any, like, pre-interview rituals that you kind of swear by?
Well, I would say, you know, each format is different, but as far as the starstruck thing, I'm not going to tell you that I never was starstruck by by people in this business. I certainly, when I was, you know, in a dorm room interviewing somebody who was in the running for an Oscar, that was pretty exciting and pretty, you know, I guess you would say starstruck. But sure. I think I got that part of it out of my system early on, and it became more about the challenge of making the most of the opportunity. If you're with somebody who doesn't do a lot of interviews, and you can get something new out of them, that's the challenge. That's exciting to me. And I'm not saying I'm not excited if, you know, Oprah sits down across from you to do your podcast. That's pretty thrilling. But it becomes much more, I somehow, for whatever reason, am able to shut down that part of it and just get right into it, because I know I'm up against the clock. Usually these are pre-negotiated where it's like, all right, we have an hour together.
Sure.
And I don't want to waste time, you know, fawning over somebody, because I feel like that's going to eat into the time that I could be, you know, what is ultimately going to be appreciated by people in the long run, hopefully, who end up listening, is going to be the content, not the fluff. So I definitely pinch myself once in a while when, you know, it's somebody that has meant a lot to me. And generally, those are actually the people who are, you know, the golden age stars, the older people that are still the one, you know, they're the ones that I got into this originally because of. So, you know, the ones that have really truthfully probably meant the most, you know, to me are maybe not on the podcast always, but, you know, I had done before the podcast existed, I had done a thing with Kirk Douglas at length going through his whole career. I once, you know, sort of had a informal interview with Olivia de Havilland. You know, people like that are the reason I care about movies. So to me, it's not that I don't also love Meryl Streep or whoever else, but it's just I just hold these other people in a sort of different regard.
So in covering the current award season, do you take a more scientific approach? I know Mike and I kind of recite your opening paragraph of the Feinberg forecast before every episode. But, I mean, we're curious, like, are you employing algorithms? Has Vegas tried to hire you? You know, could you give our audience a bit of a understanding on how you kind of create the forecast?
Yeah, where does your warlock powers of predicting this stuff come from, basically?
Well, I think that it's very nice of you to characterize it as that. I've certainly had plenty of misses over the years, but I try to, you know, the reason that there is that intro at the front of the forecast each week is to kind of convey that, look, there is no science to this. There are techniques that sometimes work better than others. And, you know, so there are statistics, like I say, that I was paying attention to even before I ever imagined there was a career doing this, where it's just, all right, so this genre movie tends to work, or statistically, you know, this never happens, or this happens. You know, there are just rules that if you obviously, you know, immerse yourself in the history of this stuff, they just start to seep into you. But beyond that, yeah, I mean, there are things that certainly earlier in the season, before we start having results from other awards groups that precede the Oscars, a lot of it is a gut feeling. A lot of it is talking to voters to get a sense of what their thought process is. It's not because that, you know, even if I talk to 400 voters, I'm not sure that's a scientific sample of 8,000, but it does allow you to understand the types of things that they're thinking about. So, you know, with Green Book, it's helpful to know, does it seem like this media hoopla over the, you know, the coverage of the family's issues with the movie, for instance. Has that penetrated the Academy members, or are they not even aware of it because they don't pay attention to the same things that we do?
That's one of those running questions.
Yeah, so those kinds of things, it's, but, you know, at the end of the day, like for this year, with a category like Best Supporting Actress, which we may at some point come to, their stats can only tell you so much. And so at the end of the day, part of it is just having a hunch based on experience and familiarity with history and whatever, and then just saying, you know, I've got to take a chance. It's an educated guess, but it's not a thing that I would bet my life on. So, and then there are other times where I almost would bet my life on it based on other considerations. So it really depends case by case.
So like best original song this year is something you're comfortable betting your life on, I would imagine.
I won't bet my life on it, but I'll bet something else. I would, you know, and now that apparently, and you guys are able to go up if you want, it's a little far for me, but if you want to drive up to New Jersey, apparently they just legalized Oscar betting in the U.S. for the first time in New Jersey. So I would guess that a lot of people are going to put their houses on Shallow, and I hope they win.
I'm afraid of the look in my co-host's eyes right now because he's a big gambler.
I'm no stranger to Atlantic City, yeah. But yeah. All right, let's dive into this award season in particular and some of the categories specifically. You already touched on some of them, but is there anything that you see that separates this award season from any of the rest you covered? Is there anything that kind of makes this particular one in 2018-19 stand out as compared to previous years for you?
Yeah, I think it's felt very mean-spirited. I think that instead of being a celebration of the movies, I think it. I don't know if it's a reflection of the society at large. Often it is, and right now a lot of people, especially in this business, who are generally of one political persuasion, are not happy with the leadership of the country overall. And I think, look, the Oscar race often reflects the zeitgeist. And so the fact that we're all I don't want to speak for you guys, but myself, I think I wake up every day a little annoyed and angry at what we're dealing with.
Feel free to speak for us too there, Scott.
Yeah. You do. Yes, sir.
Well, you know, so you get it. I mean, I think that to some extent that cannot help but influence the way you feel about other things. And so still, though, I feel like, you know, it has gotten a little mean-spirited and cutthroat in a lot of ways. And part of that is also because there hasn't, you know, no one front runner has emerged clearly in several of these categories, including Best Picture. I think Roma's probably got a slight edge, but it's close enough and attainable enough to others that they're gonna fight just as aggressively. And that brings out not necessarily the best in everyone, but yeah, I mean, I think that to me has unfortunately been the main takeaway.
Scott, we got to ask, the popular film category, you know, talking about the awards season being a little bit mean-spirited, it kind of got started off on the wrong foot. Do you think it's coming back? Do you think it matters whether Roma or Black Panther, kind of two ends of the spectrum, if one of those two movies wins, does that do something to that category's, you know, demise, or does it save that category if something like Roma
wins? That's a very good question. Yeah, it's a good question, because if Roma wins, or if I'm trying to think if there's, you know, if the favorite wins, these are not movies that necessarily had mass appeal. So I think it would make people think again about the need to reward or to involve in the show, to more involve in the show movies that people in the general public actually care about. And to be honest, I was a contrarian on the popular Oscar, because I think it actually wouldn't have been the worst thing if they had rolled it out in a way that was thought through. The biggest mistake they made was putting it out without having really made a game plan of what it was specifically representing, how it would work, and also calling it that. I think it was a stupid name to call it, because if what are the other movies? It's the not popular Oscar. So I think that, but the underlying idea that you would find a way to put on the show movies that the vast majority of the rest of the country actually cares about, when they are the people that keep in business the companies that make these other movies, I think it would not have been a huge sacrifice to have an award to acknowledge those other movies. But I think that, especially since they're generally not included in the major categories. This year, as it turns out, there are a few of them that are, and I think that's great, but I don't think we're trending in the direction that, you know, the public and the Academy are going to increasingly agree more on movies. I think it's moving further and further apart. So I understand the concerns about, you know, when you have a popular Oscar, does that mean that you say, all right, well, I can honor Black Panther there, so I don't have to put it in Best Picture? I get that concern, but there mm-hmm. should be some way to figure out, maybe you vote the popular Oscar after voting for the other Oscars take place, and so it does not appear on the same ballot or something like that. And again, I wouldn't call it the popular Oscar, but I think that they right. should find a way to acknowledge. Otherwise, why should somebody who goes to the movies every weekend, in the way that, based on the box office, most mm-hmm. people are going to different sorts of movies. And I'm not saying they're right or we're right or whatever, but it's just the reality. So if we want people to care about the Oscars, is it that terrible a thing to throw them a little bone, one category, when there are 24 others that represent, sure. you know, the rest? But I understand a lot of people think I'm crazy.
Speaking of how, you know, the audience, you know, takes in movies at large now, do you think Netflix has really stepped onto the scene this year and become that major player like all of the other studios? Do you think all the nominations reflect that? Or you think Roma's up there despite being a Netflix film? How do you feel Netflix is doing
that's,
this?
Yeah, it's interesting. That's a good question. And I don't know that we'll ever really know if it's I think that the bottom line for Netflix is that they are now, nobody can say that that being associated with Netflix is going to keep you from getting a Best Picture nomination. And so for them, for their purposes, it's a great thing, because it opens up probably other major filmmakers to being willing to work with them. And also the fact mm-hmm. that they are willing to give, even if it's just a sort of a token theatrical release, it is, you know, we're not going to, if you go with Netflix, you don't have to worry that your movie will not be available anywhere on a big screen. So I think that for Netflix, it was a big win to just break through. I actually never really believed that there was a large number of people who were saying, I can't vote for something because it's Netflix. Sure. I just think that actually the two prior examples of movies that didn't make it that were from Netflix, the The Idris Elba, Beasts of No Nation, right, and also last year, Mudbound. I'm losing my mind. Yeah. Those two, I don't know that they were just, first of all, you know, they were good movies. And maybe mm-hmm. I think Idris Elba probably deserved a supporting actor nomination, and Mudbound got a supporting actress nomination and some other stuff. But I don't know that if they were distributed by anyone else, they would have gotten a Best Picture nomination. So I think, though, it just perpetuated this notion that there was a big resistance in the industry to Netflix. The reality is Netflix employs a ton of people who are in the industry. And there's only a few people who are financially in a position to say, I will never deal with Netflix, because that's, you know, that's where we're heading. So I think that, I think it's going to change things in the sense that, you know, probably for other streamers too, that, you know, people just, you've got to go to people where they are. The biggest problem for Netflix is that a movie like Roma on TV is not as gripping or powerful. And a lot of people I talk to, including Academy members, say, like, after 20 minutes, I've had it. And they go and, you know, check their phone, or they go to the refrigerator, as one member put it in our upcoming Brutally Honest ballot. Or they, you know, it just, it is. The problem is that when you're in a theater, you behave differently than you behave at home.
Absolutely.
And you also have a harder time just, like, getting out of it. So that's the biggest issue Netflix movies are still going to have, which is that, you know, how do you – you've got to have something that grabs people's attention a little bit more than – I mean, some people with the Roma opening sequence with the water, they give up before it even makes it out of the opening sequence.
Right, right. We call that the Academy kind of sniffing their own farts sometimes. They lean towards yeah. the artsy stuff as opposed to anything more mainstream. But with the diversifying nominations that we have here, and before we jump into a couple just specifically about different categories questions, do you – I mean, you're on record in a couple years ago of when the Academy made made this effort to start going more diverse and getting more young people involved and, you know, spreading their wings a little bit. You were on record saying it was going to take a couple years before you think that really made any impact. Since we are at this point now this year where we do have kind of a more diverse selection of nominees, whether you want to talk about the Roma ones, you want to talk about the surprise for cinematography we have, do you think we're at the point where diversifying and maybe younger Academy's voice is being heard? Or do you think it's still a ways to go and it's still kind of the people at the top that have always been there are still in control for the most part?
It's very hard to say. I think that the other thing to consider is that I believe that, I'm just making sure I believe this, but I think I do, that the same Best Picture nominees that were nominated this year, I think would have been nominated if this year happened, you know, 4 years ago before the demographics of the Academy really changed, because they are great movies. I was always skeptical of the notion that the Academy was a very racist group. I think that I'm sure that any group of that size has racists among them.
Sure.
But the idea that they were, you know, actively trying to defeat movies because they had black people or whatever, I just don't buy, and I did not buy at the time. I think that there are certain what I've heard explained again by one of our voters this that we're, you know, doing Brutally Honest Ballots with this year, and I think it's a good point, is that it's not maybe – it's more like maybe as you know, for an older – a group of, you know, largely older white people, it's not that they did not want – Straight out of Compton, for instance, to do well. Mm-hmm. It's that it's just a little bit different from their experience. But they were the same people who were happy to support 12 Years a Slave and I think probably in large numbers Moonlight, because, well, I would say, let's stick with the 12 Years a Slave example for a second, because here's a movie where it's about the black experience. It's a movie where white people, you know, it's a dangerous and long road to go down, because no matter what you do, you're speaking in generalities. But what I think the thing with young people have maybe made them more open to a wider variety of experiences. But I think it would have been wrong to ever say that, you know, look, this is Hollywood. Suppose this is not, we're not talking about certain parts of the country that are notoriously racist. This is not that. I mean, these guys were making movies about the civil rights era and giving Oscars to Sidney Poitier before the rest of the country was even desegregated. So I think that the idea that suddenly they're, you know, because they didn't give even Brokeback Mountain Best Picture, they're a bunch of homophobes. I think it's just a jump to a conclusion. I think that there are other factors that come into play. But, you know, this year has been interesting because there is greater diversity than before. But I think that's more to do with the fact that a larger number of movies about diversity that are also very good happen to exist. And it certainly hasn't hurt their prospects that the Academy is now demographically more diverse, but I don't know that they wouldn't have resonated even before that.
So you still, the ideal is what you believe, and that you think the Academy is still judging everything on its merit more so than any kind of preconceived notion, at least in general.
There are always going to be other considerations that factor into play, whether, you know, I'm voting for this person because I know them, or there are human things that do come into play. And for some people, those things are bigoted, but I've never seen any reason to believe that it was in large numbers the case. I think it's more about what you can relate to in your own experience that you are going to gravitate towards. And so that's why I think it's generally a positive thing to have made the efforts of the last few years, but I don't think that it's necessarily, I think it's in some ways addressing a problem that wasn't totally there, but it still is not a bad thing that they, you know, that they have made strides to be more inclusive, because that's never a bad thing, but it doesn't mean that they were racist before. It means that they were maybe more limited in what they were open to before. But again, I still think that the same Academy that gave, you know, the Oscars out a few years ago, I don't believe they would have, you know, that they were so intolerant or unopen to things that they wouldn't have recognized that, you know, Black Klansman or Black Panther or whatever were important movies. It just, I think that that's reductive to say that they would not have been able to do that. It's not changed that much. You know, if you look at percentages, yeah, they've added a lot of people in the last couple of years, mostly diverse sorts of people, but even that has not massively changed the overall percentage of the Academy that is still, you know, not diverse. And that's, you know, it's not to say that they shouldn't try to do that, but I don't think that the nominations this year are going to be that different because of the last, you know, the changes of the last few years to the membership.
Interesting enough, so if it is a meritocracy, let's get into just a couple specific category questions for this year's Oscars before we let you go. Judging things and judging these films on their merits, there was an article you released today, Oscars, How Did A Star Is Born Become a Long Shot for Best Picture, in which you basically describe, for lack of a better term, the rise and fall from awards prominence about A Star Is Born. And judging by the sources that you comment on in your piece there, it kind of seems like has Bradley Cooper kind of become a bit of a pariah in this process, and that's kind of what's tainted people's views for the most part on this?
Well, I wouldn't call him a pariah, but I think that, and by the way, I think the movie can still win some major awards. I want to be clear about that. But I think that the sense of enthusiasm for it and positivity towards it within the industry has changed since it was unveiled back in the fall. I think that's just, you know, and I look in this piece, I look at the reasons why that might happen. And again, I'm coming from the perspective of somebody who really likes the movie. I put it in my very publicly released top 10. You know, I'm not somebody that's coming at this as a hater of the movie or anybody associated with it. But I think it is interesting and worth looking at to try to understand how a movie that was being talked about as, you know, unbeatable early on has now become, it would be a shock if it won. So what's changed? And yeah, definitely part of it, I talk about the fact that the framing of what the movie is changed from, you know, we as pundits were being told, don't, you know, it's not an awards movie. It's a well-made commercial movie. That's part of why it's not going to Telluride, but it's only going to Venice and Toronto.
That's one of the most fascinating things from that piece is that how WB kind of came out and before it hit, classify this, telling everyone that this isn't to be considered for Oscar's nomination, when it seemed like the punditry at large thought this was a vehicle.
Not that it's not to be considered, but yeah, I mean, it was, they try to, for them, they're a big studio, and they are expected with a movie like this to first and foremost make a lot of money, and probably what they were thinking is that if you, just, you know, if it's too immediately thought of as an awards movie, clearly those that in some ways limits your audience. And so they wanted to make a lot of money first, and they did. And then anything else that happened would be gravy, but I'm not sure that helped them to frame it in people's minds early on that way. But beyond that, I think they've had a bit of an identity crisis with the movie overall, because, you know, you've got things where there's just a whole variety of reasons I get into in the piece, but I think that, you know, and then also their talent has in some ways helped them immensely, that these are the people who are central to their movie, but also in some ways not. You know, this New York Times profile early on of Bradley Cooper really did not help them at all, because it created the idea that he is now, you know, this guy who we had all first come to know and love through, you know, comedies and fun movies was now too self-serious. And again, he's entitled to be that way. A lot of filmmakers are, certainly Christopher Nolan, another guy who Warner Brothers has dealt with quite a bit over the last few years. But I think that it was further perpetuated by just the demeanor of the talent and the campaign at things that happened afterwards. So even if the New York Times thing was unfair, which it may well have been, you can't know how somebody chose to write their piece, but it wasn't discouraged by the way that things unfolded afterwards. And so, you know, but ultimately the biggest problem for A Star Is Born probably has been that it is not in any way of the moment. And that is inherently the case because it's been made going back to the 30s. But there is a hunger these days, it seems like, to reward movies that have something to say about the world, that are good and have something to say about the world. This is a very good movie that could have been made at virtually any time and was. And so without a peg to something of real world importance, it becomes harder to compete these days when every other one of these Best Picture nominees, to one extent or another, can argue that it is speaking to an issue of the moment. And that's why I think, by the way, at the Grammys, when Lady Gaga won, she tried to make, you know, suggest that this movie was about mental health or whatever, was ultimately about that. And, you know, she may believe that, but I think that it's not coincidental that they're just trying to, you know, drop talking points like that at this point, because we haven't been hearing that argument all year, because I don't believe it's a legitimate argument. I think it's, you know, it's as much about mental health issues as it's about, you know, incontinence issues and peeing your pants at award shows. So it's a problem. You know, they could never say this movie was really about something. And granted, I'm not saying that to be a Best Picture winner, you have to be. It certainly is not in the requirements that voters receive. But it's just the way things have trended. Again, maybe because we're in such a politicized time that people are hungry for a movie that not only is entertaining, but has something to say about the world. And I'm not sure that this one does. And I think that probably hurt it.
Scott, it was a great read. And that next Feinberg forecast, when it does come out, I'm going to be curious to read the tea leaves on A Star Is Born. And also this other category that we can, if we can talk about before you go here, Regina King, early momentum in award season as in supporting actress. Rachel Weisz wins the BAFTA on her home court. Do you have any kind of read on this now? Is this one of those categories that just is really bizarre this year?
It's probably, to me, along with maybe best film editing, mm-hmm. the hardest to know what to do with this year, because this is one where there are a million each one has major considerations where, you know, right now, I think Vegas or Atlantic City, at least, would probably be putting the odds on Regina King. And I get it. You know, she is a wonderful actress who we in America know from her TV work, who, you know, 3 Emmys in the last 4 years, I think. And, you know, that's great. But then you start getting into the other arguments for her prospects, and I start to be skeptical. She won the Best Supporting Actress Critics' Choice and Golden Globe Awards. Those are both voted only by journalists. There are no journalists in the Academy.
Right.
We, as journalists who cover entertainment, know her from her TV work and have a certain regard for her because of that.
Sure.
But the fact that she wasn't nominated by SAG and wasn't nominated by BAFTA is troubling to me, especially because there's only one person in history who has ever won an Oscar in the years that all these awards have coexisted, who was not previously nominated for either one of those awards, which to me are much more relevant because there are actually a lot of actors in the Academy and there are a lot of British people. And if neither constituency chose to even nominate her, that's a problem. And also the fact that her movie overall does not seem to have resonated, maybe wasn't even watched by a lot of these branches that are now going to pick the winner in that category, that's also disconcerting. But then you say, well, who would it be instead? And I guess you go to Rachel Weisz because of BAFTA. She won at BAFTA. But then you remember she's British and that she's also competing against her co-star here, where being British is not going to give her a built-in advantage.
Sure.
And being against the co-star is going to be a problem. So who's left after that? You've got Marina de Tavira, who's great in a movie that a lot of people love, but nobody even heard of her 6 months ago. And I'm not sure there's usually they want to see people, you know, put in a little bit more work before they reward you for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I come back to Amy Adams, who is in a movie that they really like, for better or worse. A lot of people disagree, but look, got all the key nominations. And I think the fact is that there's a lot of people that are used to seeing her name on the ballot year after year. They realize that she's only one nomination behind Glenn Close for being the most nominated
person. She's an Academy darling,
alive,
for sure.
And she's an Academy darling, but she's never won. So I actually currently, my gut is Amy Adams, but I don't.
Wow.
It's hard to defend because she hasn't won anything yet.
Right,
so
right.
It's all over the place, you know. And I guess that I would understand somebody saying, the smartest, safest pick is to go with Regina King just because she's already been winning things. Mm-hmm. But I just caution people to remember that what she's won, there's a total of one voter from either of the BFCA or the HFPA is also an Academy member. So
that's a crazy
stat. I don't necessarily put that much into the weight on what she's already won.
So it sounds like you put more weight into the fact that Regina King didn't get nominated at, like, say, the SAGs than you do at the fact that the winner of the SAG didn't even make the Academy field and beat out people, other women who did, the two from The Favorite specifically, and Amy Adams.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's what makes this so bizarre is that, yeah, as you say, Emily Blunt is not even nominated. So, but what that makes me say is SAG, which, again, the largest body of actors that we deal with, and actors are the largest branch of the Academy, like probably about 1/7, maybe more actually. The fact that they chose not to go with Rachel Weisz, Emma Stone, Amy Adams, that was pretty interesting too. So now it just further muddles the water here, so I would not feel confident about any prediction here. I think Marina de Tavera could freaking win. So I think that, you know, it's, and nobody, she wasn't even people, you know, she wasn't even nominated for anything.
Wasn't even supposed to make the category. Yeah.
Scott, I wish.
Right. And yeah. People like, yeah.
It's fascinating. I wish you could have seen our faces throughout that whole discussion. It just validated so many things, so many rabbit holes we've gone down, you know, with no exit. And, right. Man, this was a pleasure talking with you. I got to ask you, what's coming next for you this week at the Hollywood Reporter, your Oscar coverage, awards chatter? What do you got going on?
Do you plan on sleeping at all this week?
Well, actually, right now I'm feeling better than I felt in the last few weeks, because last night we finally went to the printers with our Oscar issue of The Hollywood Reporter, which, as you can imagine, I'm expected to contribute a good amount to. And so I'll tease what's in that and what's coming up, you know, as far as stuff that's going to roll out. But luckily, I'm going to try to, you know, take it a little easier the rest of this week. But what we have in that issue is our Brutally Honest ballot, which our first one, which now a couple of these other outlets have chosen to rip that off, but we it's not that we didn't have ours ready, but we don't feel that we want to put those out while voting is still open. We're not trying to change anybody's mind. We're trying to let people see what after the fact, before the vote, before the show takes place. But anyway, so that ballot is a fun read because we always get a good character, smart person, but also somebody with a little personality to be in that. We also have something that I worked very hard on, a oral history on the 20th anniversary of Shakespeare in Love, Upsetting Saving Private Ryan, about how that happened, and got a lot of people who were part of that to weigh in. And also
fascinating.
Use some never seen quotes from Harvey and from Steven Spielberg. And so not that we did not go and interview Harvey now, but we had previously unpublished interviews with him that we're drawing on, and same with Spielberg. So that's one that I think is good. And then we also have the will win, should win, you know, thing where our critic picks and explains why he thinks they should win. And then I have to go on the record for the first time about what I think will win in all the major categories. And then lastly, with awards chatter, the last contender interview is going to be Ruth Carter, the costume designer of Black Panther, but also all of Spike Lee's movies, which you know, that's exciting. And I guess that's pretty much it for now.
Yeah, that's all of Hollywood. That's it. Well, that sounds absolutely fascinating. I can't wait to get my hands on that.
Yeah.
And that Shakespeare in Love retrospective really piqued my interest, because that is a story that I've just been, they've been one of my favorites throughout Academy history, certainly the last 20 years. Just to wrap you up here, we, again, cannot thank you and The Hollywood Reporter enough for your time and giving us a couple moments here. And thank you very much. We hope to do this again. And this was very insightful and very, on a personal note, it meant a lot to us. So thank you from the bottom of our heart. Before we get you out of here, last question, as is tradition here on Mike and Oscar, we like to ask our guests if they can pitch us what their version of the worst movie possible could be. So if you wouldn't mind indulging us with all the years of knowledge and work that you have behind you, blending in old Hollywood and modern today Oscar races, what would be Scott Feinberg's worst movie possible?
All right. Well, first, let me thank you guys. I've been aware of the fact that you guys have been very kind on the podcast over the last months, and I appreciate that you're even interested in having me on. So thank you very much. And
that's very flattering and humble.
And also, go UConn, I think, right?
We would support,
can we say? So that we can agree on that for sure.
Yes, sir.
And then as far as the worst movie ever, let me lay it out for you. You ready?
Sure.
So you've got a group of people that are giving out awards, and they pick a host, and then that blows up in their face. Then they pick a category, and that blows up in its face. Then they decide, what can we possibly do that would piss people off even more? And that blows up in their face. And so now we're going into the actual show, and the minute they have something that is not pivotal to the content of the show, an award category, whatever, you've got film editors, cinematographers, short filmmakers, makeup and hairstyle people. The minute that you put one thing on the show that is, you know, not essential, like a clip reel or a comedy bit or a song that's not one of the nominees, that they're going to get further beaten up. So yeah. To me, that is a movie that is equivalent to watching a train wreck. And I hate to say it because I love the Academy and the history and whatever, but man, that is going to be hard to top.
What an answer. How poetic. That was beautiful. Thank you very much for that.
You are the man, Scott Feinberg.
No problem.
Ladies and gentlemen, Scott Feinberg, the man in the industry. Be sure to check out Feinberg Forecast. Be sure to check out his podcast over there, Awards Chatter. For the Hollywood Reporter. And thank you once again, Scott, for giving us some time here.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
See ya.
Well, that's why he's the best in the business. No joking around about that. That was our interview with Scott Feinberg, MMO interview, Scott Feinberg of the Hollywood Reporter. We cannot thank him and THR enough for letting him give us a few moments of his time. And what a wonderful insight into what's going on in this Academy this year and this award season at large.
Mike, I took a break after this podcast. We both did. And I went outside. I basically did like the reaction of every rom-com protagonist after their first kiss. You know, I just did like spun around. I put my hands in the
Simple
air.
Simple Minds, Don't You Forget About Me was playing in the background.
I sang a fist, song, yeah. You know, to no one in your snowy driveway. And that's how happy I was because that was such a great interview and Scott really lived up to it, lived up to his billing there. And it was, you know, we've been wanting to talk to him forever. I think when we started this pod, we started reaching out. Scott just really came through. Thank you, Scott Feinberg. Thank you, Hollywood Reporter. Mike, we want to give a last shout out to Awards Chatter.
Yeah, Awards Chatter, Scott's podcast there. He really does talk to some of the heaviest hitters in the industry. It's amazing the roster of talent that he goes through. Definitely worth checking out. Very interesting every time he has someone on there. The Hollywood Reporter, you heard Scott touch on it. Their Oscar issue is going to be hitting newsstands. If it's not out now, it will be in the coming days, I'm sure. A lot of fascinating. That Shakespeare in Love thing, I know I gloated about it, but that Shakespeare in Love upset of Saving Private Ryan, I'd love to hear what's some of the word of mouth there. The oral history of that from some of the people that were involved is really a fascinating thing.
He'll have another Feinberg Forecast, I think. He puts those out the day before the Oscars, or 2 days before, per usual. And look out for everything he does with SAG-AFTRA and all the Q&As. If you go on YouTube right now, if you want to learn how to interview somebody, and if you want to learn how to manage somebody interviewing him, then he did that perfectly well too during that episode. He really put us at ease. I felt very comfortable talking to him, and it's cool because we all kind of grew up in the same area, so that was really cool.
Yeah, very humbling, especially the part where we actually get a little bit of validation knowing that we're not just talking out of our asses this whole time.
Was it me or did he validate a lot of our theories?
I was quite surprised, and it made me very happy. Yeah,
like we were fist pumping throughout that episode. Like I said,
as far as all the stuff we do, we are here. We're giving you a new episode every day of this Oscar week up until and through Sunday. We're on the board. We just looked at our whiteboard now, and we have stuff laid out until at least Tuesday following the Oscars, so we'll see what happens then. You can keep up with us. We are at MM and Oscar on Twitter. We're Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, MikeMikeAndOscar.com @gmail.com and on Reddit. And don't forget to check into everything we've done in the lead up to this award season. We have a whole roster full of OSPs, our Oscar Sprint profiles where we take a lot of the contenders, pretty much every contender of every major category for these Academy Awards on Sunday, where we give you two reviews for the price of one in every OSP, where we give you a non-spoiler review, followed by the spoiler-filled version, taking a look at all those films, their highlights, their shortcomings, where they shine when put up to the Oscars lens, all in the culmination of coming out and predicting, for the most part, where they will end up this Sunday.
We have our last category overview tomorrow, where we're talking about adapted and original screenplay. That is number 8 or 9 on that series.
Yes.
Yes. I don't remember. I can't count either. But we have almost 50 movie reviews of 2018 films, whether it's an OSP, a movie event. We also do retrospectives of past Oscar winners. If we have a remake coming out, like we did with Suspiria, we had the original 1977 version given a retrospective first. We also did that with Mary Poppins. We have our MMOW, Mike and Oscar Weekly variety show. That is where we kind of review the award show of that weekend.
Yeah, MMOW, to taking a look back at the Hollywood week that was and getting you ready for the Hollywood week to come, as we call it. It's our news and information show.
I like that
show.
Tagline a lot. And we also do a lot of audience interaction. We play a fun game, 6 Degrees of MMO, where we connect to entertainers, let's say, because we've gotten off the beaten path. We used to go actor to actor. Now we're going actor to cartoon this week, which is fun. We talked about that yesterday in MMOW for this coming week, where we went from Bo Burnham to the Grinch, and people had a lot of fun with that and their responses. We read a bunch of those off every week. We got a lot of fun stuff for you in the next couple days.
Yeah, as two lifelong cinephiles and / former jocks, it's easy to make the analogy that this is our Super Bowl week, and that certainly rings true. We have a new content coming every single day.
Mike Oscar Daily.
We wanted this to be we want to be your go-to for award season. We want to make award season year round. We want to be your home base for where to get you filled in and have the Oscars meaning a little more to you this year, despite all the yuck and controversy that may be coming alongside it. We want to be the one that help you guide you through and give you a little insight to every aspect that may pertain to your life and get you a little more enjoyment out of it.
Plan your movie night with us. We got a ton of movies reviewed in our catalog, like we said. We love to love movies, so we're primarily a film appreciation podcast. And we even go into other genres and non-Oscar films. We covered the entire Halloween franchise, all the Mission Impossibles. The MCU was the very first of these series that we did. We did almost 11 episodes on that, and we got more to come. We did the Conjuring films as well. We got more to come. We might do Pixar.
You can find us on TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, everywhere that you hear podcasts. Just type in Mike and Oscar. Whether you are just a award season fan or just a movie fan in general, welcome home, good friend. And we usually end every episode here with also Mike leaving us with some valuable words of wisdom. So Mike, Scott Feinberg episode in the can, Tuesday of Oscar week in the can, rolling right along. What are some words of wisdom?
Scott, if you started a cult, I would join it.
I think and we I already
be,
have.
Yeah, I would be one of the first ones to join it.
I don't think he started. I think we have on his behalf.
And all of you, all our MMOers should as well.
Yes. Co-signed. Thank you once again to Scott Feinberg. Thank you once again to The Hollywood Reporter. Guys, when reality does suck, you can come over here and watch movies with us. We will keep you in the know. We will see you tomorrow for yet another brand new episode of MMO.
See you.